Hi, everybody. It's Michael Bennett, and I'm extremely grateful that you're taking time to join this call today. I hope that you're doing well, that your families are doing well, and that you're taking care of each other during this difficult time. Our goal with this call is to provide a brief update on the pandemic and the federal response, and then to connect you with resources and do our best to answer your questions. I want to introduce a few others on the call who are going to say a few words. They'll also be available to answer your questions later. We have Dr. Mark Learned, who's the Vice President of Primary Care and Urgent Care at Kaiser Permanente, Colorado. We have Greg Stasinos from the Colorado Office of Emergency Preparedness and Response. Mark Christman from the Colorado Health Emergency Line for public information. Jareen Peterson from Mile High United Way in 211 Colorado. And after everybody speaks for a few minutes, we'll open it up to your questions. If you have a question, please dial *3 on your phone. You can start doing that now. You don't have to wait for us to finish talking. Please dial *3 to ask your questions while you are listening to the opening remarks. Let me start with where things stand on the pandemic. As of this morning in Colorado, we're at over 3,300 total cases and 80 deaths. Nationally, we've had more than 214,000 cases and over 4,800 deaths, which is up threefold from a week ago. I regret to say this, but we've had a steeper curve than any other industrialized country in the world has had, and we've now got more cases than anywhere in the world. And on testing, you may have heard a lot about it. Well, we tested a million tests nationwide. That's actually true, but if you put it in context, we're still far behind what's happening in other countries, and this is something that we've been spending a lot of time working on, because we've really got to get to a place where our healthcare workers can get tested so they can get back to work, and so that in the end we can actually reopen our economy. So we've got a lot of work to do ahead of us. And over the past month, the federal government has tried to catch up with three phases of effort. The first phase came in early March, $8.3 billion to expand testing and treatment. The second phase, which we passed the following week, focused on the people who are already losing their jobs or getting sick. It provided paid leave, expanded unemployment benefits, and did some more to improve testing. The third phase, which we passed last week, was a massive escalation in the nation's response. It was a $2.2 trillion bill, as you've read, with a major focus on shoring up our healthcare system and our economy. The healthcare side alone had $150 billion in it, including $100 billion to help our hospitals and providers cover their expenses during the crisis, $27 billion to develop our vaccines and treatment, and to purchase more equipment, PPE, it's called, personal protective equipment, for the national stockpile for our folks that are on the front lines, billions more for state and local health agencies to purchase more equipment and to expand telehealth services. A centerpiece of the bill, and then that was the healthcare side. We also had an economic side as well. A centerpiece of the bill is direct cash payments to give people some relief during the crisis. In a few weeks, the federal government will send a one-time payment of $1,200 per worker and $500 per child for people making up to $75,000, and for couples making up to $150,000 for a typical family of four. That's $3,400. In support. We also supercharged unemployment benefits in the package. Workers who've been laid off will now get unemployment for an additional 13 weeks. On top of their base benefit, they'll also have an additional $600 per week. And for the first time, the benefit will now cover contract workers, gig workers, and the self-employed. The package also includes a bunch of support for small business. It has $377 billion to support small business through loans, loan guarantees, and loan forgiveness. The program has been designed to provide immediate relief to small businesses and to reward them for keeping their employees during the downturn. If I had had my way, that number would have been bigger, but hopefully we can address that going forward. There's a lot of other pieces of the bill, including support for businesses, schools and universities, state and local governments, and the social safety net, but we can leave that for Q&A. We know there are things that are going to have to be strengthened and fixed. This bill came together very quickly, which is why in the coming weeks, please reach out if you see things that we can make better. You don't have to wait for these calls. You can connect with my office either by calling my Denver office at 303-455-7600 or by going to our website, which has a number of resources as well that you might find helpful. So with that preliminary stuff out of the way, I'm really happy to turn it over to our panelists, very, very knowledgeable people about both the healthcare crisis and resources that are available to all of you. I'm so grateful they took time out for joining this call today from their busy schedules. Before Dr. Learned begins, I want to remind you to dial *3 to ask your questions while our panelists are sharing their opening remarks. Dr. Learned, with that, I will turn it over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bennett. I appreciate it. My name is Mark Learned. I'm a primary care internist by training, and I'm the Vice President of Primary Care and Urgent Care for Kaiser Permanente in Colorado. I'm going to share with you some information about the biology and some medical information about the coronavirus. And my disclaimer is this stuff changes so fast. If you've been watching the news or consuming any other information about the pandemic, you know that things change hour to hour. So I promise I'm giving you the most accurate information I have right this minute. The coronavirus that we're seeing now is a different one than usual. We see coronavirus every winter, but this one is more infectious. It's actually more infectious than the usual seasonal flu, and it's slightly more infectious than even Ebola. It's on a par with the Spanish flu from 1918, and if you're not an infectious disease history buff, and why wouldn't you be, I would strongly recommend Googling the Spanish flu. What the world went through 100 years ago is very much what we're going through right now. This virus causes a lot of different symptoms, and it can even be asymptomatic, which is challenging. You can not have any symptoms. You can feel normal but be infected. Typically, though, adults who are infected with this coronavirus get fever, cough, and shortness of breath. It's transmitted generally through droplets. Droplets are produced by cough and sneeze. So that's the main form of transmission. If a patient is coughing and sneezing, that's a high-risk patient to transmit this virus. It can be transmitted asymptomatically, and that's why social distancing is so important. But the risk is lower with an asymptomatic person than a coughing person. These droplets that I mentioned can travel in air about 6 feet at maximum. They're just too heavy. They don't go farther than that. And that's why you've heard 6 feet as the social distancing recommendation. The social distancing is critical because if we go about our regular daily life and don't change anything, a single infected person is likely to infect about 400 other people over the course of a month. If we put into place the really, frankly, drastic measures that are in place now, we can limit that to only 2.5 people in a month. It's a drop of 200-fold, right? That's why we're making such a big issue of social distancing. That's why Governor Polis, Mayor Hancock, and others are considering extending the order through the end of the month to meet with President Trump's recommendation. And that's the benefit, is it really drastically cuts the risk of transmitting this infection. What if you get sick? What if you have a fever or a cough? Well, of course, if you think you're having a medical emergency, you're going to call 911. If you're sick and you're not sure what to do, I want you to contact your healthcare provider. KP has ways for you to do that virtually. You can email, you can have video visits, you can do something through the app on your phone that's sort of like texting. If your provider has any of those methods, use them. But otherwise, call. What we don't want you to do if you have a fever and a cough and you're not sure what to do, do not walk into an office building. There's two reasons for that. Number one, we don't know yet what you have. And if you have coronavirus, you might transmit it to others. And number two, you might catch something else. And people who get coronavirus and then also get influenza or RSV do really poorly. Stay home if you've got a fever or a cough. And I'll speak more to that during the question and answer period. Thank you, Senator Bennett.
Thank you, Mark. I really appreciate that. It's a phenomenal summary. Greg, would you like to introduce yourself and take it away?
Yes, thank you, Senator Bennett. I appreciate it. This is Greg Stasinos. I'm with the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. Specifically, my day-to-day duties, I am the Operations and Response Section Chief in the Office of Emergency Preparedness and Response. But currently, I've been tasked to the State Emergency Operations Center to be the Assistant Incident Manager, or the Deputy Incident Manager, in the Public Health and Medical Operations Section. What we're concentrating on right now is to plan for any future medical surge. So we're working closely with our hospitals to gain certain types of data, such as bed counts on a daily basis, what type of equipment they still have available, especially ventilators that will be dedicated to a medical surge, and any pharmaceuticals that they would need, and trying to get ahead of any pharmaceutical shortages. So that's what we're concentrating on right now. We're working closely with our hospital partners and our local public health agencies to also stand up or identify sites where alternate care sites will be located, and put those in the best possible areas where they can meet the demand should we see a medical surge develop. So thank you again for having me, and looking forward to the conversation.
Thanks, Greg. And Mark, would you like to take it next?
Thank you. Thank you all. And
thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bennett, for bringing us together today. My name is Mark Christman. Sounding a little rough today. I do apologize for my voice. I'm going to try to hold it together here. I'm a supervisor at Rocky Mountain Poison Center. It's a division of Denver Health, and I oversee this public health hotline called CoHelp, which you introduced, and that's the health emergency line for public information. You know, our number is everywhere. We can be reached at 303-389-1687. There is a toll-free option on the sites as well. Our team is available 7 days a week. We answer calls from the public and occasional healthcare provider. And we use the specific guidance prepared by the experts and Greg's teams at the State Health Department. So our aim is to share this consistent messaging and, you know, the very great information we heard from Dr. Learned, you know, the CDC, the state health information. And so we're going to share that information with the public. If we don't have the information, then we're going to try to guide you to the right place to find it, the resources where you can find your answers. We do have a language interpretation service, so we can serve everyone in their preferred language, no cost to the caller. Now, we're not a medical line, and as the doctor pointed out, if you are sick, you do want to contact your doctor, but we can share the recommendations from the experts. And so in the case of COVID-19, we're advising the same basic instructions: stay home if you're sick. Don't go into the emergency department for minor symptoms, or call ahead, as you pointed out, so you don't infect the waiting room or catch something else. If people don't have a doctor, the uninsured, underinsured, we will definitely try to help them find a provider, clinic in their area, or connect them to a nurse advice hotline to help make those health decisions and when it's time to get treatment. Our top questions from the past couple weeks, you know, should I be tested, or what should I do if I think I need to be tested but can't find the place to do it? And then probably third most common currently, what businesses are essential? What should be closed? Or how do I report a business that isn't closed but I think should be? And so in summary, CoHelp's relaying the public health facts and standard messaging to the general public prepared by the national, state, local health experts. And then we give our data back to Department of Health so they can better understand what questions the public needs. And, you know, hopefully we don't get to talk all in forums like this every day, so we want to get those, you know, the burning questions from a public back to the state health so they can answer these questions more quickly. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, I think we'll turn it over to Jereen Peterson from Mile High United Way in 211 Colorado. I'll remind everybody one last time, if you've got a question, please push *3. Jereen.
Thank you, Senator Bennett. Just to let everyone know, 211 Colorado is the COVID-19 resource and referral hub connecting people to human services statewide. 211 is a confidential multilingual service connecting people across the state of Colorado, and in our database we have over 7,500 health and human resources for people to access. Those kinds of services that people can be helped with are housing, rent and utility assistance. You can call to make a SNAP benefit online right now, childcare referrals, food and meals, transportation, employment, education, medical clinics, and other government assistance. The easiest way for people to search these resources is to go online to the 211colorado.org website, where you can put in your need, put in your zip code, and then you can search the services that you need online. That's the quickest way to look at the resources. But sometimes you need to talk to a person and really kind of talk out all of the different things that you need. So you're more than welcome to call, just dial 211, and a resource navigator will pick up your call Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, and will really work with you through all of the different resources that you might need. You know, and we also do not offer any medical assistance, but we certainly make the referrals to the other hotlines and the other organizations that can provide you with medical care. And I think what we want to encourage people to do is not to be hesitant in this period of time to ask for help and ask for assistance. There isn't any question that is not a good question to ask, and people are really there to help and to reassure people during this time when people are experiencing a pretty high level of anxiety about things that are going on. So thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you very much, Doreen, and thanks again for being on the call. We're going to start taking your questions now. I think Alexandra, who's on the call, will begin introducing questions for us. So let's get started.
Yes, Beverly from Durango, your line is now unmuted. Please introduce yourself and ask your question.
Hi, I'm Beverly from Durango, and I'm not sure who to pose the question to or if it can be answered at this point, but I just was curious in terms of the higher percentage of people who are dying. More specifically, let's say March 20th, there were 363 positive cases just in Colorado with four who had passed, compared to now with 3,342 positive cases and 80 people who have passed. So that number of people who have died has grown from 1.1% to 2.4%. And I understand we're testing more people. I would think that maybe that would make the numbers go down, not up. And while I know this is probably half the amount of people who die globally, I'm just curious in Colorado if we're seeing this increase from the lack or overwhelmed staff or lack of PPE or ventilators or what you can attribute to that increase in people who are dying.
Thank you, Beverly. I wonder, Dr. Learned, if you might want to take a crack at that.
Absolutely. Thank you. It's a good question. When you look at the testing numbers of people that we've tested, let's say here in Colorado, and the number of people who are dying, it looks alarming. I can tell you that because of the testing shortage, which we're still working our way out from under, we are preferentially testing people who are sicker. So it's sort of an interesting disconnect, right? The CDC and state and local authorities really want to test a broad section of people so that we can get an idea of what this virus is doing, where resources need to go for healthcare, where economic relief might need to happen. But from the standpoint of me trying to manage an individual patient in front of me, really, if you're well enough to be at home, then frankly, as your doctor, I'm not concerned why you have cough or fever or shortness of breath. You need to go home, you need to take Tylenol, drink fluids, and wait to get better. And whether you have coronavirus or influenza or something else is not that interesting to me if I'm primarily concerned with you. The place where a coronavirus test really holds clinical value, where we might do something different for a patient if they have influenza versus coronavirus, is if they're sick enough to need to be in the hospital. And so really the people that we're primarily testing are people who are sick enough to be in the hospital and therefore at more risk of their health. So I think you're seeing two things in those numbers. Number one, we're not testing the asymptomatic people who are going to do fine. So more of the people that we're testing are sicker and are at risk of dying, unfortunately. And number two, we're not yet able to test a wide swath of asymptomatic people. If we tested every single person in Colorado and knew exactly how many cases of the virus were out there, the death rate would look much, much lower.
Thank you, Doctor. That's really interesting information. Go ahead, Alexandra.
Yes, Amaya from Boulder, your line is now unmuted. Please introduce yourself and ask your question.
Hi, my name is Amaya. I'm with CU at Boulder. And I think my question is to Greg. And as part of Colorado's amateur radio emergency services, are there any events that you could see in the near future which could need our assistance with respect to COVID? And if yes, how do you plan to communicate this message that we need your assistance apart from the local Aries nets so that we may potentially volunteer and help out?
Yes, That's a great question, and we do. We coordinate very closely with the Amateur Radio Emergency Services Group. And right now, thank goodness, most of our communication mediums, email, phone, things of that nature, the mediums that we use on a regular basis are still intact. What we see, our plans call for the integration of ARIES, is if one of our primary systems of communication does go down, and we have to certainly deploy or initiate our agreement with ARIES to be posted in hospitals or in other local emergency operations centers. So at this point, I'm happy to say that our communications are still very well intact. But if we do see something drop off, if we have a major malfunction with a communication medium, our first call and our first contact would be to the ARIES folks. I work closely with the ARIES Emergency Response Coordinator, Emmett Hurdlebrink, and I have him on speed dial. We would coordinate instantly to try to get those ARIES representatives deployed and into the right areas to support communications.
No, thanks. And Maya, that's a really generous offer of help. I wonder, Jereen, whether you got thoughts more broadly about if people want to volunteer or contribute or somehow help their fellow citizens, if there's other things that people could do.
Absolutely, Senator. If you also go on the website Help Colorado Now, which is a statewide website, it has all the listings of the volunteer opportunities that exist across the state of Colorado, and that's easy to access online. I think the other way to assist is many, many nonprofit organizations that are currently open and serving people are in much need of supplies and equipment in terms of helping keep things clean, to be able to serve their patients. People are needing access to food. Food banks are also needing assistance across the state of Colorado, and they're trying to make that possible to be able to have people volunteer in safety. So there's a number of ways to do that and still be able to do that in a way that doesn't put people at jeopardy. You can also go online at the Colorado Help Colorado Now website if you could choose to volunteer or donate. The governor has set up a Colorado COVID relief fund, and right now there's about $8 million in that relief fund, and there's hundreds and hundreds of nonprofit organizations across the state that are making application to that fund this week.
Great. Thanks, Jereen. I think we're ready for the next question.
Yes, Jill from Glenwood Springs, your line is now unmuted. Please introduce yourself and ask your question.
Hello, Senator Bennett, and thank you very much. My name is Jill Pedcocker. I'm the Executive Director for the ARC of the Central Mountains and based out here in Glenwood Springs. I'm actually, I've met you a few times, so I'm pleased that you, and I was on your last week's call too. So thank you so much for continuing to communicate with us, as you always do. You're welcome. My question is, being a director for an organization, nonprofit that supports people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, we're very aware that there have been other countries that have experienced discrimination against people who may be of a more vulnerable population. So our concerns are, one, safety-related as far as medical needs may be concerned, and also now that schools are back, we're finding a lot of issues trying to get some of our CDE folks to be able to communicate with our schools that are working so hard, and then down the pipe with our special education needs. So I'm wondering if you have anything or on your horizon as far as trying to tighten up, making sure that very quiet population of special needs and our vulnerable population access and functional needs are being addressed.
So let me, Jill, by the way, thank you for everything you do. And this is a real concern for me. I used to be the superintendent of the Denver Public Schools before I was in this job. And I've been hearing from educators all across the state and parents, people worried about how we're going to meet the needs of kids and serve them with their IEPs. And I don't think we've yet have a complete answer on that, but it's something that has been very much on my radar screen, and we're going to keep working on that. If you have if you have issues or the people in the community do, please just reach out to our office so we can follow up. I'd say more broadly that we need to be concerned always about that we are implementing things fairly, that there's not discrimination. We've got an excellent in-state casework team that can get you to the right place if you feel that you've been discriminated against or somebody else has. The office number is 303-455-7600. I have deep, deep concerns that what we're going to see through this crisis across the country is that in many ways we're living in two Americas, and we've had this terrible economic divide now for decades. And I think what we're going to see in the aftermath of this healthcare crisis is that we've really got a profound divide when it comes to the healthcare for the lowest income people in this country and working people in this country and more affluent people. And I hope that throughout the crisis, we're going to implement the bill in a way that and the follow-on bills in ways that supports everybody, including our most vulnerable populations. And then as we come to the backside of this, we take a hard look at ourselves and say, what is it we can do to create more equity and more fairness in the country? I'll just give you an example in the bill, and then I'll stop. But there was a substantial amount of housing support in the bill that we just passed, $4 billion for emergency assistance to help people who are at risk of being evicted or experiencing homelessness, and another $3 billion for rental assistance for low-income renters. So, you know, if you're hearing, for example, about housing discrimination, I hope you'll let us know about that. Thanks again for everything you do. You take another
Alan
one?
From Fort Yep, all set. Alan from Fort Collins, your line is now unmuted. Please introduce yourself and ask your question.
Hi, Alan from Fort Collins. Many of us have been working for a number of years now against Trumpy's horrendous immigration policies, and we're quite concerned about the detention facility in Aurora and other places where immigrants and the health care there being abysmal. We're also concerned about other incarcerated persons, too. So I'm not sure who can address this, but I don't think we're hearing very much about that in the media today.
Thank you.
If we can kind of raise that issue up for a lot of people. And, Senator, I'd like to thank you for all you're doing on behalf of immigration. And I really get a lot from Priscilla's emails out, keeping us up to date, too. Thank you.
Well, good. Well, Alan, maybe I'll take a stab at that and see if anybody else wants to talk about it or we can move things. But thank you for caring about this and thanks for calling. You know, an illness like COVID-19 is so dangerous to everybody, but especially dangerous, as we were just talking about, to the most vulnerable people, and that includes people who are in detention or incarcerated. So I would say, Alan, first, because you know Priscilla, so you know our office's commitment to this work, if you are hearing anything about people who are detained or incarcerated and showing symptoms and not getting the treatment they need, we'd like to know about it as fast as you can call us. And my office number, again, is 303-455-7600. I think we also need to make sure that detainees are getting access to their lawyers and other services. In general, we've just got to keep pushing here. So I appreciate all the work you're doing. I don't know if anybody else would like to address this. Happy to have you do that, or we could move on to the next question.
Next, we have Betty from La Junta. Your line is now unmuted. Please introduce yourself and ask your question.
Hi, this is Betty Blanco from Lahana, Colorado. And Senator Bennett, I'd like to thank you for taking my questions and thank you for your service to our country. I'm sure
that,
all
Betty.
Of this has got to be tough on you, but I just want you to know that people are praying for you because we do know it's tough on you.
Thank you, Betty. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. My question is twofold. I live down here in rural southeastern Colorado, and we need supplies to be forthcoming. I'm especially looking at our farmers and ranchers who provide for our food, and I'm wondering how can we make sure the rural areas of Colorado are taken care of, and they can get whatever they need to fight this virus. And secondly, our doctors are at the front line of fighting this disease. They are in the business of healing. How can we make sure that they get the supplies and assistance that they need to do their jobs? And I'm especially looking at individual doctors who are in the rural areas. And what I'm thinking in my mind is this hydroxychloroquine is reputed to be very effective against this disease. So I'm wondering, how can we get that into the hands of the individual doctors so that we can get back to normalizing our lives and getting back to work? Thank you very much for taking my question.
Betty, I can't thank you enough, but I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Learned to answer the last question, and maybe the other two would like to address the first part. But I will say a word about this, because serving on the Agriculture Committee for the last 11 years, this has been a real focus of mine. We have got to point out that to the country that we've got to do more for our rural communities, especially for critical access hospitals who are already struggling. Many of our rural hospitals are struggling now because they have no elective procedures, which is, you know, what their revenue mostly consists of. And I'll be talking to Secretary Azar in the next week at HHS to make this case. I know we've got at least one hospital in the northwest part of the state who only has literally just days of cash on hand, and it's unacceptable, you know, certainly during a pandemic. I was glad that in the most recent coronavirus bill, we included a number of provisions to help support rural communities, including $185 million to support rural critical access hospitals, rural tribal and telehealth programs. We've got money in there for distance learning and telemedicine. And $100 million to create more access to broadband as well. But I wonder, Doctor, if you could take the question on the drug or the question of equipment or support for doctors across the state. Maybe people would be interested in knowing something about the shortage that we're facing and why there is a shortage and how we're thinking about collectively trying to address that.
Sure. Yeah, let's talk about medications first. So hydroxychloroquine, there have been others that have been reviewed, sort of some of the medicines that we often use for HIV, which is also a viral infection. There's a list of about 8 or 10 medicines now that are being considered. I would view all of them as experimental. I certainly can't tell you that they're going to be effective against this virus, let alone highly effective. I think the place where we are experimenting with these medicines is in ICU patients who are on the breathing machine already. And in those folks, they need something to help them avoid dying from this infection. There, you're kind of willing to roll the dice on a medicine that you're not sure is going to help. But I think these medicines have been talked about in the media as though they are known treatments like antibiotics for bacterial infections, and they're nothing like that. Additionally, they have toxicities. They can injure your liver, your kidneys, change the way your blood works. There can be some really negative side effects. So I would say we should think of these medicines as experimental only. And really the place where some are trying them, as I said, is in those critically ill patients who frankly need any little edge that we can give them. But if you have a fever and a cough and you're worried you might have coronavirus, but you're well enough to be at home, there are no medicines that I would recommend giving you that are aimed at the virus. The medicines that you should take would be cough medicines, Tylenol for fever, and supportive care like that. Lots of fluids, lots of rest, all the things we learned from our mom about how to fight viral illnesses. Rather than work to push supplies of these medicines around the state, I would like to see us spend our time and energy making sure that every doctor, but not only doctor, every healthcare worker, every frontline responder has the right protective gear, PPE, as Senator Bennett mentioned earlier, personal protective equipment. It's not complex, right? It's a special kind of mask that's tight enough to keep the virus out of the air you're breathing. It's goggles to protect your eyes. In some cases, it's gowns and gloves to keep droplets off of your clothes and your hands. those are things that are going to be a lot more effective than any medication that we know of so far.
And I would just say for everybody on the call, you need to know that our healthcare workers who really are on the front lines of this effort are really at risk if they don't have that equipment. And we were caught as a country flat-footed with our supply chain. We are doing everything we can to shovel supplies into our hospitals and emergency rooms and doctor's offices, but there's a lot more for us to do. And we have to be very grateful for the healthcare workers that are doing the job they're doing under these circumstances.
If I may add one thought, this is Mark from
yes,
CoHealth.
Please. Mark,
since you know, when we don't have a major public health event going, so much of my work is through Rocky Mountain Poison Center. I can't stress enough that we beg people not to take these treatments in their own hands, to work with a doctor, to not take unproven medications on their own, you know, that they've heard about on the internet or wherever they might have heard about this stuff, and to always call the Poison Center 800-222-1222 if you're concerned for any kind of toxic ingestion or medication interaction concern that you need immediate help. We'll try to get you the resources and into medical care.
That's a great point, Mark. And I have never given anybody medical advice in my life, but I'm going to give it to everybody right now for the first time. Do not listen to politicians when it comes to these kinds of questions. Please listen to your doctors and your healthcare providers. That's where you're going to get the best advice.
Next, we have Richard from Canyon City. Richard, line is now unmuted. Please introduce yourself and ask your question.
Canyon City, thank you so much, Senator Bennett and panel, for this forum. The question I have, please, is why hasn't there been more effort by the decision makers to require and mandate masks and hand protection, even improvised, be used in grocery stores by the clerks and the customers, where so many masses accumulate daily, touching and breathing on our food sources? I just noticed that social distancing seems a nominal recourse if the virus is circulating and setting on so many surfaces in the stores.
Doctor, would you like to take that?
Sure. I have a couple of thoughts for the caller. We've got evidence about using masks, and the evidence is quite clear that masks are most effective when you put them on the sick people or on people who are in contact with known sick people. What we are less sure about is putting masks on people who aren't apparently sick. So you'll remember in my opening comments, I said, yes, this virus can have no symptoms, and you can pass the virus even when you have no symptoms, but it's hard to do, and generally that happens when people are in close contact with each other. So as long as a grocery store worker, for example, isn't fevering and coughing directly on surfaces, they're not going to be spreading a lot of virus around. And I know employers are just as scared of this virus as everyone else, and they're working very hard to keep sick employees out of the workplace, in the places where we're picking up takeout lunch, in banks, in other essential industries like grocery stores. But when we've studied everybody wearing masks and gloves, as happened in parts of China, for example, we suspect that probably wasn't as effective in limiting the spread. Number one, many of those people weren't exposed to the virus, and therefore the mask and glove didn't help them. Number two, your average person actually doesn't wear protective gear correctly. Once you put protective gear on, you don't touch it until you're ready to take it off. And most people simply just, no matter how good their intentions are, they can't wear a mask without touching it, fidgeting with it. It feels funny. It's in the way. It's hot and uncomfortable. And when you touch it, you then contaminate yourself. You contaminate other surfaces. So that has proven not to be an effective way to limit transmission.
I'll just say for my part that I did a call yesterday with a senator from Pennsylvania where we were asking the CDC to give a clearer guidance on the mask issue, in part because we want to make sure that the healthcare workers have the masks and that everybody else is not going out trying to buy masks that should be that our healthcare workers should be using.
But it is interesting that the CDC has said they haven't said we're against homemade masks, and I think there's some evidence that there's been some benefit from that across the world, and I've actually been wearing one when I go outside that my wife has made for me, and I think we're just going to see in the coming days what we end up ultimately doing here.
There's certainly a common sense perspective to be had that any barrier is better than no barrier, right?
Yeah, and also it's also true that the mask does not replace social distancing. In other words, the social distancing is the most important thing that we can do. And if the mask adds a little bit to that, then it would be useful. Doctor, do you mind talking about foodborne virus? That was part of the question, and I know that's on the minds of a lot of people, is like, you know, am I going to get this from my food at the grocery store? What can I do to mitigate that risk?
Yeah, thanks for the reminder. Two things you reminded me of. I'll talk about the foodborne side, but you're absolutely right. Protective gear is no substitute for social distancing. Protective gear is what we wear when we have to be within a social distance with a patient in an exam room when we're treating someone. But the best and primary protection is social distancing. In terms of virus being on food, et cetera, so again, you know, the virus is mainly spread through droplets that are generated by cough and sneeze. So the better job our colleagues in the food industry do at keeping sick workers out of the workspace, then the better protected we all are. That's our first line of defense. Second would be just thoroughly washing whatever it is we're going to eat. You know, we all wash our produce. If something is packaged, you know, it's probably not overkill to wipe that package down right now just to be on the safe side. This virus is not foodborne in the sense of contracting food poisoning. You know, you won't eat an infected food and get sick from it. But if that food was coughed or sneezed on and has virus particles, those virus particles can probably live outside the body for a period of time. We're not sure how long that is. It's probably not days. It's probably hours. So my mom was asking me what to do with her delivery of frozen meat. And I said, you know, you're going to put that in the freezer. It's going to be in there for weeks. That virus is going to be long gone by the time you get ready to eat it. So as long as you're storing it in cold for a couple of days, that's probably okay. If it's something that you're eating sooner, then you wash it thoroughly like you would have anyway.
Great. Thank you.
As a quick reminder, if you have a question, you can ask it by dialing *3. And our next question is from Frederick from Grand Junction. Frederick, your line is now unmuted. Please introduce yourself and ask your question.
Hello, Senator Bennett. My name is Frederick. How are you today?
I'm well. How are you, Frederick? Thanks for calling.
Well, thanks for allowing me to ask this question. Senator Bennett, my question has to do with the economic impact of COVID-19. So I think you're probably the person that I'm looking to answer this question, or at least elucidate on what my concerns are. When the government decided to institute stay at home and to classify certain businesses as essential and non-essential, thereby requiring some businesses to shut down, it has created a chain of events that is causing people to become unemployed, who can no longer afford to pay their rent. And so landlords are evicting these people in some states. I know this personally because I have a broad range of friends from coast to coast. I actually have a friend who owns commercial properties that house businesses, and he's a very decent man, and told his businesses in those plazas that were not allowed to stay open not to worry about paying their lease payments until this was over. And when he went to talk to his banks, because the properties are under mortgages at different banks, one bank said, we'll work with you, and the other bank said, we're sorry, you got to keep making your payments. So I see a direct responsibility on the part of the government or on the part of Congress that when the stay-at-home orders were placed and when the essential versus non-essential businesses were put into effect, they have a responsibility to ensure that people are not damaged in this process economically. And I understand the bailouts with the stimulus plans and all of that. But I think something far more forward-thinking should have been done, whereby we just basically stop the financial system in these cases and tell people nobody owes anybody anything. We just put it in a stasis until this thing is over. Why haven't we done that?
Yeah, Frederick, I really, really appreciate your question. And I think the one answer why we haven't done it is we've never faced anything like this before. And I did have conversations with people as we were going through the stimulus bill about whether there might be a way to just simply freeze everything for, you know, a period of months so that we could just preserve as much of the economic ecosystem as we have and create as little harm as possible. And it just couldn't figure out how to make that work because of every single contract that's been issued and been entered into, every single lease, and all the rest, many of the kinds of things that you were talking about. I will talk a little bit about what is in the bill, what we tried to do, and we're going to have to come back. I should have said that earlier. This is not going to be the final piece of work that we do here, and we're going to have to continue to begin, you know, pushing on ideas like yours, which are how do you do as little harm as possible, and how do we also have the benefit of the fact that our banking sector is actually, you know, one of the stronger parts of our economy today because of the work that we did before. So there are a number of communities across Colorado I know that have put in place moratoriums on evictions and foreclosures. I think that's the right thing to do. We've done the same thing at the federal level, federally supported housing through the bill we just passed. The bill includes a 60-day foreclosure moratorium for all federally backed mortgage loans. Borrowers with FHA, the VA, USDA, or loans backed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which is a lot of loans, will not see foreclosure actions and can't be removed from their homes due to foreclosure during that time. Please let us know if you have one of those loans and you're being foreclosed upon, because we can stop it. The bill also provides owners of multifamily properties with federally backed loans having a financial hardship up to 90 days of forbearance on their loan payments. During that forbearance period, the property owner can't evict the tenant for non-payment of rent and can't charge the tenant any fees or penalties for non-payment of rent. This provision applies to all renters who live in properties that receive federal subsidies, such as public housing, Section 8 rental assistance vouchers or subsidies, USDA rental housing assistance, or low-income housing tax credits. It also covers any renters in properties where the owner has a federally backed mortgage loan, and that includes loans backed by FHA, USDA, and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So, this, you know, in my view, this is not a time when people who have lost their jobs through no fault of their own should be forced to leave their home, making themselves and their communities vulnerable. And we also need to make sure that support is getting to people so they can stay current on their rent and utilities. That's why we push for a major expansion of unemployment benefits and the direct payments to everyone, including our most vulnerable households. And got to make sure that we're keeping people insured and caring for people who are not. So this has been a challenge unlike any other that we've confronted. And I believe we will overcome it, but we've got to pitch in to help each other and keep an eye on each other to make sure that we do. So, Frederick, I appreciate it very much.
Our next question is from Doug from Silverthorne. Your line is now unmuted. Please introduce yourself and ask your question.
Yes, I'm Doug Baer from Silverthorne. I was volunteering at a food distribution center, and a homeless gentleman was determined to be COVID-19 symptomatic, according to public health. Now, for me personally, I was supposed to have an operation this last Monday, and the doctor, of course, wasn't going to operate on me because I had that contact. And so I volunteer in a number of different capacities, and I can't do that. Of course, the world is not going to end because I'm not doing that. But my concern is this gentleman walking around being fully symptomatic. He was offered shelter and testing by the county, and he refused it. So my question is really twofold. One is, what is our moral obligation in this kind of a situation? And then the second part is, we live in America, people have rights. So where is that balance? What can be done with this situation, and what should be done, in your opinion? Whoever wants to answer the question.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Doug. I think I am less well qualified than almost anybody on the call. So let me turn that over to Mark or Greg or Dr. Lerner, or Doreen, anybody who'd like to weigh in on that.
It's Dr. Lerner. I can certainly start. So I'm going to have to make up some of the details that I didn't hear in the question, but I assume that when we say this man was COVID symptomatic, we mean he had a cough and a fever. And so again, as his treating clinician, I'm not sure I care why he has a cough and a fever. I want him to be away from other people and be able to have a respite bed until he's better. I was on a call earlier this week with the director of Urban Peak, which is a homeless shelter here in the Denver area. And, you know, illness in the homeless is always a gigantic problem because they're in very close contact in shelters. It's not possible to socially distance in a shelter. They're always overcrowded. And so that's really hard. Now, they are working on some arrangements here to work with hotels who have unprecedented vacancies right now and provide some housing for people who need time and space to get better. But to the caller's point, if that man said, no, thank you, I don't know that we've got any authority to compel him, and that's where I'll say I'm out of my depth and defer to others on the call. It's a very tough situation. What we would want is for that man to have a place to go to get better. If he needed hospital care, then we would talk about testing, and there might be other public health reasons to test him not connected to his individual care.
Right. Mark or Greg, do you have anything you'd like to add?
This is Greg, and the only thing I can do is piggyback onto Dr. Lernan's advice. There is when public health orders are issued either at the local or at the state level, what we do is we hope that folks understand those public health orders and help us to carry those out. So you know, staying at home, implementing social distancing, and then just doing the very basic things like washing hands, covering their coughs is what we're hoping that will help to lower the curve, as we keep saying. We just hope that folks adhere to that public health order, ask for any clarification when needed, and stay home when possible.
Yeah. Next question. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think the other issue is the person who is experiencing homelessness doesn't have a home to go stay in. I think that's a big issue, and sometimes people that are experiencing homelessness also don't know what other resources might be available for them, and so I think it really is a reaching out to that person that is ill, right? We don't know what kind of ill they are, but to really reach out to talk about what available options could be available for that person when they might not even know what those things are. And how our communities, like the doctor was saying, how our communities, and many of them are renting motel rooms, are opening recreation centers, are trying to do their best to help people that are experiencing homelessness, because unfortunately they don't have the same opportunity and options that many other people do. And so we have to create new and innovative opportunities in each community to help a population of people that really need some tremendous assistance.
Thanks, Shereen. That's a great point. It's Michael Bennett again, and I just want to remind people that if you've got a question that you want to ask our phenomenal panel, please hit *3, and you'll be able to ask the question.
Our next question is from Kathy from Colorado Springs. Kathy, your line is now unmuted. Please introduce yourself and ask your question.
Yes, thank you. My name is Kathy. I'm in Colorado Springs. I'm an instructional coach in one of the school districts down here. We've been turned upside down, of course, as everyone else has. And education is something that I advocate strongly for. I work in a low socioeconomic school, and Comcast has offered to give folks internet access so that they could experience distant learning. And we're working on other alternatives for those that do not have devices. But then that leaves me with this question about equity and whether there's any resources out there. If Comcast is offering internet service and you don't have a device to work with, how can we get devices to the children? And I'm speaking mostly about elementary. We're working very diligently down here to get those things out to our high school kids who are working on graduation especially. But then that leaves our elementary kids without something to work with. And most of them are very poor. They're just trying to either get to work or just try to survive and try not to become homeless. And so that leaves me with, how can we help them? And how can we make this more equitable for our kids?
I really appreciate what you're doing. Thank you for teaching. I've got some things to say about the federal government response, Kathy, in response. But, Jereen, I don't know whether you've got ideas particularly about the digital divide for kids and the devices that they might now need and don't have at home. Is there a place that people can go? Jereen, I was asking you that question. I don't know if you heard.
I did. I'm sorry, Senator. I was on mute. I apologize.
And Kathy,
to your point, I think many families are experiencing that they don't have internet or they don't have access to a device. And so in your local communities, I think in Colorado Springs, you have your local Pikes Peak United Way that's also working with your foundation community in Colorado Springs. That may be one opportunity to contact your local United Way to see how they are doing distributions of their funds and working with their local foundations to maybe fill some of the gaps that the school districts are not able to fill. With the release of the governor's fund for COVID, I think we'll see many applications also that nonprofit organizations would like to be able to help fill that digital divide by getting devices out to families. So I think you will see in the very near future more people being able to help with some of that assistance. And part of the issue is actually being able to get hands on those devices. Right now, the backlog of ordering some of those computer devices is taking a little while because of the demand. But I think you will see more people and more organizations and more philanthropic efforts to get devices and technology into underserved and under-resourced communities.
This has been a perennial issue with, some of our smaller rural communities where it's not necessarily about the device, but about just having access to high-speed internet, and the school districts are having to work together to try to figure out how to, in those circumstances, deliver for kids, and I'm talking to people around the state about what we can learn from each other about how to do that. I did want to mention that, Kathy, that the bill did have $25 million to support distance learning and telemedicine, just to address that kind of question that you have, $13.5 billion for formula grants to the states, which will then be distributed. 90% of that money is going to be distributed to local educational agencies and school districts to use for coronavirus response activities. So that's going to include, the rules haven't been written yet, but it's going to include planning for and coordinating during long-term school closures, purchasing educational technology to support online learning for all students served by local school districts, and additional activities that are already authorized by federal elementary and secondary education laws. So I think, and although this isn't relevant to kids, I also wanted to plug that there are a number of veterans in Colorado and across the country who don't have access to tablets or technology like this. And so the VA, Congress gave the VA money so they can provide our veterans with the technology that they need for healthcare. And to all of you who run into these kinds of challenges, I hope you'll call me and let me know, and we can go to work on trying to make things better.
Thank you. This will be our last question this afternoon. We have Rafaela from Colorado Springs. Your line is now unmuted. Please introduce yourself and ask your question.
Hi, Senator Bennett. My name is Rafaela from Colorado Springs, and I really appreciate having this forum to get all this information. So I'm a self-employed massage therapist, and a lot of us in the field are just wondering, when will Colorado.gov be set up for us to apply for unemployment insurance, and what will that look like for unemployed people?
Thank you for the question. Does anybody want to take that from the state perspective, or would you like me to?
I do have, I'm sorry, this is Mark from CoHelp. I do have a number and a website you can find on the page. Let me verify. My links don't move. You know, stuff has moved around so much. This would be the...
I'm trying to find my notes as well. So
oh, absolutely.
Go ahead.
So my, yeah, but I'll tell you the Department of Labor and Employment, their number is 303-318-8000. It's kind of a lengthy website, and that was why I was trying to make sure. There are some resources for workers and unemployment insurance links. There's a link online where you can do this. This is on Colorado.gov. Department of Labor and Employment. We'll see if we can't make a, if I can't find an easier way to, it's a really long website. I just don't want to read it out.
Yeah, I can get, actually, do you want to read it out or did you, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. The one I have, excuse me, one more time, Colorado.gov /pacific/CDLE/information/resources/coronavirus. There's got to be an easier way that we can get people there.
Yeah, well, I think, Rafaela, right now, I think the state is waiting on the federal Department of Labor to provide guidance on how to put the benefits in place. One of the reasons why we did the cash payments was that we knew it was going to take a while because there are 50 different unemployment agencies in the country because we got 50 different states, and we were hoping to be able to bridge people over. I thought there might actually be ways to make it faster by putting it on the electronic benefit cards that we have, but we weren't able to get that done in this first package. The good news is, as you probably know, we expanded unemployment benefits to the self-employed, to contractors, to gig workers, and other people with what's called 1099 income. Since that's new, the Labor Department's got to issue guidance on how that's going to work. And in the meantime, I think you should continue to check Colorado's unemployment page. I know on my website, which is bennett.senate.gov, we have a citizen's guide that has the link to the state unemployment page. So you can get it, again, at bennett.senate.gov. Bennett is B-E-N-N-E-T, just one T. So we're going to try to push these guys as fast as possible because it's critical for us to give people the protection that they need. Alex?
And that was our last question. So I think it's time for just a wrap up, and I think we'll be all set.
Before I wrap up, but if any of you, Dr. Learned, Greg, Mark, Jureen, in the order that we started, if each of you has something you'd like to say that either came up or didn't come up, please do, and then I'll say a word and we're done. Doctor?
I'll just emphasize, if you have symptoms or somebody you know or love has symptoms and you're worried about them, please don't hesitate to contact your healthcare provider, but please try to do that without walking into the facility. We don't want to expose you to anything that might be in that waiting room, and we don't want you to expose those folks to whatever you have, whether that's coronavirus, influenza, or something else. And of course, if you have a medical emergency, you always call 911. And thank you for being here and being on this call. And thanks, Senator Bennett, for putting this together.
Thanks so much for making time. Greg?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Senator Bennett, and thank you to the rest of the panel. It was great to hear from some of the public that we're here to serve. And I just want to let people know that our coronavirus website, the website that's being put together by the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment and the Colorado State Emergency Operations Center, is always up with the best information that people can consult. You can find that website at covid19.colorado.gov. And there's various links that you can go to regarding public health orders, information on the case data, so on and so forth. But thank you for having me, and have a good afternoon.
Thank you so much. Mark?
Yes, no, thank you all. I think kind of stole my thunder there. Very, very great answers from everyone. I was going to point to that same website, let you know our phone number is on that site, as well as 211 is their resources are linked on that page as well. So it really is a fantastic one-stop shop, and we'll be happy to share any information, you know, as it comes in on our line. Thank you all.
Thank you. Jereen?
Yes, and thank you, Senator Bennett, for having us also. Just to remind people, you're more than welcome to go to the 211colorado.org website. Some of the questions that came up on the call today are on our COVID website, with some answers and more directions to a lot of the state also website. So it's all in one place that people can go to. But if you really would like to talk to an individual, they are more than happy to spend time with people with as much time as you need to walk through the situation to be able to meet your resources and meet your needs.
Thank you so much, Doreen, and thank you to all the panelists for a wonderful job. Really, really appreciate your time. And I want to thank everybody for being on the call. There were a number of questions that we did not get to. We'll have a way of answering those questions. And as I said at the outset, please don't hesitate to reach out to my office either through our website or the phone number that I gave you earlier. Look, this is a very difficult time in American history. It's a difficult time in Colorado's history. None of us would have asked to be going through this, but that's been true of every crisis that we've had as a country, and we've got to pull together. It's up to all of us to provide the support that our healthcare frontline needs. It's up to all of us to make sure we're doing the social distancing, which is what each of us can do to try to flatten that curve, to keep people out of the hospital.